You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. And I'm your host, David Gilmore. Today we are engaging with a poet who has lived on the waters. He covers the waterfront of the Salish Sea and is well-known probably in poetry readings for his very fine new book, Broken by Water. Welcome, Gary Thompson, to Sound Poetry. So you've got one now that's a little more ominous. Well, it's not ominous so much. It's a narrative with an incident, his brother's dinghy. Mm-hmm. That one now is, we don't know particularly the brother, but it's an interesting change, a sadness in this one that's about how things go still.
Right. And perhaps it warns us that even though lots of good things happen aboard Keats, there are incidents that can bring that joy down quickly. This was a true event. A neighbor who was somewhat questionable in terms of rational thought and actions, his brother was taking care of him. He lived with his brother. His brother's dinghy. Our neighbor, a man uncharted by reason, borrowed his brother's inflatable dinghy from this dry docked yacht at dusk and went fishing. The little outboard puttered across rough open water to the lee of Blake Island, where he dropped his line in and dropped dead. Gulls, the lap of waves against the rubber hull, his last imprint of the world, or the steady wash of tide that pushed his tiny boat into the charted sea lanes out.
It's a pretty nifty opening and closing with the uncharted and the charted. I realize that you had something to say in both those words. I even noticed it in the uncharted by re. I thought, that's very interesting. I wonder what charting we're going to see. And you fulfilled, you know, an expectation there in your last line. The sea lanes are charted.
They try to make sense out of things. They try to lay a route.
Yeah, and this is another example of how one is broken by sea. Yeah,
by big water, correct, in my opinion.
So we'll have a little bit of history here. Poets Cove, we're going to take a trip to Canada.
Poets Cove is on South Pender Island in British Columbia, and you'll see everything's explained in the poem, I think, and if not, we can come back to it. Poets Cove. And in we chug to clear customs at Bedwell Harbor, as we've always done. Of course, it's now called Poets Cove, but what troubadour would bicker with that? When the warship HMS Egeria anchored here in 1905, Pender Island was almost unsettled by Europeans, the Crown simply taking stock of its New World Empire. Poets Cove. Poets, plural, no possessive. Which sounds about right, given poets lay claim to next to nothing, unless words and rhythms are claimable. Bedwell Harbor, likely named for a Royal Navy officer in the 18th century, is now a cove of condos and timeshares, constructed where a First Nations village once thrived, crushed shells from its midden still forming the beach today. Now it's a destination wedding cake place where the rich will arrive and be accommodated as usual since 1492. So customs accepts us, assigns us a number, and we're in, here in Poets Cove, as if we belonged.
The way the Northwest and the British Columbia Islands were settled, a very spotty kind of history that's not always told. I mean, who knows of this Bedwell, you know?
Right. I worked hard, starting in several visits in Canada, to find out exactly who the Bedwell was. And finally, just it comes down to us surmising how the harbor got its name, at least as far as I could find. So, and I like to be an archivist and those kinds of things anyway. So, yes. You know, that's some of the way I putter towards a poem is to search out history to make sure that, you know, it's grounded in as much history as I can have the poem grounded in.
Well, except for contemporary Native American literature, you are really digging in archives for a great deal of the Indian storytelling, aren't you?
Yes, and other kinds of archives too. You know, whether it's the early pioneers or what have you. I have always believed from the first few poems I started publishing that your place is connected to the history of your place, and that without exploring that history, there are parts of ourselves and our world that we just don't understand, won't understand unless we understand something about the history. A friend of mine, a very good poet, Tom Crawford, once called me an archivist. He said I was the archival school of poetry, and I'm not sure he meant that as a full compliment, but I took it as one.
We are going to continue with some advanced lessons of boats. You did have this one worn down by reading, which as a memoir.
Worn down from reading. Worn down from reading. Yet another midlife me memoir in manuscript. I get up from the desk and out to a world that always means something. Today, it means to do us in or give us hell trying, Noah warns. A monster storm is at the coast and aimed our way. Powers already out in Cowichan, and when it crosses Harrow Strait, this storm won't be clearing customs before it smacks us too. Down at F dock, we double up our lines, add fenders, and stow everything stowable below. Even old salts and tribal fishermen are down here, which means this is a true skookum storm, not some made for TV news event. At home, we push patio furniture into the lee of the house, then sit a moment watching the distant sky darken into squall. Suddenly, I'm flooded with memories of a grade school outing that exploded into torrents and lightning that struck tall trees around us and knocked me down hard to the ground. That was a year of memorized poems where Miss Knapp bade me stand and recite No Man is an Island, the cleaned up edition with proper elocution.
Well, let's go to something now that has the advanced lesson of boots.
Okay. You recall we started out with the first lesson of boats, and it's still humorous, but it takes a kind of funny slant towards the vulnerability
of
boots. Advanced lesson of boats. Land is where the dog pees. The crew rests their achy sea legs, and the boat is hauled for new bottom paint. Land is good. But when it suddenly rises beneath the bow, the depth alarm screeches and the skipper skips breathing, his eyes fixed on numbers dropping on the sounder, the crew bracing for a crash. Wouldn't it be good to stop time? Better to go back to safe water, that primordial deep that was paradise. Better yet, if our ancestors never crawled out of there, scooted off on all fours, stood up on two shaky feet. Best we never invented the boat. This actually stems from an incident that we heard over the radio. We were following a friend of ours. In fact, he's an old salt. He's one of the people who taught me about engine room maintenance and all kinds of things about electronics. And we were following him through a very narrow and dangerous passage. We were actually not in sight, but he was talking to other boats in our group, small group, on a CB radio, and suddenly he's swearing and his boat hit a rock and damaged the propeller. We followed this all the way through by audio only, that we never saw him until we got through the passage, and then by then he was anchored. He damaged the propeller, but the boat was safe. We eventually found a port to fix it, but we never hit ground. And some skippers, some boating people will tell you that I must be lying, because if you've been boating for 19 years, you're bound to have grounded. But for some reason, maybe we were just super cautious. We never had any groundings, although we came close. And so this is kind of working off that original prompt, I guess.
Your book is a sort of odyssey, isn't it, too? It's an odyssey of your poetical imagination.
You know, I think it's a personal odyssey to understand the Northwest and to understand how the Northwest influences me and why I've become so Northwestern in 25 years. It's an inner search as much as a outer search.
There are many poems with animals, and I think there's a couple here that we can enjoy.
An owl. This, as we were just talking about inner directed, this is a very interior poem. Eventually becomes a very interior poem. An owl. An owl wakes up at 3 in the morning in the back of your skull and starts hooting. Your eyes open, but inward and night-wide. You don't breathe while the owl perches in the darks of your dulled brain and waits for fear to spook you from cover and into its talons. The silence after each hoot is like a year of your life when you were 10, and you lose count as the silences add up. Your wide eyes, with their three lids now, see the scurries in your darks, those personal creatures you prey upon each voracious hour after hour, until gray lightens the dark sky and fire hints a horizon and the owl starts to drift off. Safe and still breathing, you dare open your eyes, wiser and scared, just enough to live the day, to live the day through. And this is a lighter version. Let's see, we're a lighter encounter. Kingdom Phylum. My black dog decides to say hello to the black crow at work on the rack line at Jackson's Beach. He veers toward shore with the ho-hum nonchalance we see when cats come through his yard. It's an act, and the crow knows that, holds its gaze in ground. My dog stops within 3 feet where they pose, black beak to wet black nose, two unlikely heads of state, eye to eye, with Lord knows what to negotiate.
Yeah, the curiosity in the animals, but also there's a curiosity, a kind of nightmare quality to the curiosity of the inner owl.
Yeah.
And a man with apples. This isn't exactly Johnny Appleseed, but maybe there's something that comes to light about that old myth in A Man with Apples.
Man with Apples. My earthly efforts, small as they may be in this cursed year, amount to 31 comely apples, not counting a few the storms knocked down and one the birds got into at picking time. This espaliered apple with hardy Northwest varieties grafted to disease-resistant stock is practically fail-safe, the nursery claims. But what can that mean in this autumn world so blown apart by wind and bombs and quakes? And what should the world make of this man standing at his back gate holding out a peck of shiny apples?
Yes, we move into further dark omens.
Yeah,
things
that's
come.
True. The island broke out in poppies that May, determined dots that spotted the island from Cattle Point to Roche Harbor, a rash of raw gold that started itching at our wintry hearts and made us daffy until we all broke down and scratched them fully into bloom.
Yeah, using the metaphor of breaking out, there's another of your break words that is as we break out in pimples or chicken pox. Yeah. We're going further in the book, so maybe we're going darker in the book, but the beacon has a bit of history in it that I think you might have some comments on too.
This section of the book was the last to be completed, even though there are three or four poems that were quite early. I just never knew what to do with them. Originally, I had planned to write extensively about James G. Swann, and you'll learn about him quickly here. And then I sort of put it aside and did not follow it. I thought the book was taking a different track, but it wasn't until, you know, 2 years before it was published, 2018 really, that I realized that James Swann had to be in here as part of the historical background, as well as Chief Seattle, Chief Self, and you'll see how that works together here. The Swann poems tend to be longer several pages at some point. The section is called Northwest Likenesses. And the poem I'm going to read now focuses on Swan, but Swan brought into the present world. And to give you some background, Swan was an early pioneer on the Northwest coast. He was a voracious writer, kept diaries and wrote articles and treatises and all kinds of several books about Northwest culture and other things. He was on. And to give you my sense of the man, I'm going to read a few stanzas from the opening poem about Swan. A likeness of Swan, the man, of Boston, who arrived in Port Townsend aboard the Dashaway, the aptly named schooner that beat its way up the strait some 30 years before. He poses here in his office on Adams Street, pleased with himself, in the year of our Lord, 1891. James Gilchrist Swan. Dash away, dash away, dash away home. Except that Swan was dashing away from his home in Boston, wife and two children, in 1849, and arrived in San Francisco, not a gold seeker exactly, but a seeker. Swan's a curious man in both senses, learned and learning still this Northwest coastal world, and a curiosity to his neighbors, scholar, artist, town booster, and town drunk, a gentleman with demons.
Yes, that's a fine note. It is interesting, I think, that if you were leaving it up to the listener or the reader of a poem with Swan in it, to go to a Wikipedia or some sort of Google site, if it's possible, you might learn something, but who is going to go and do that unless they're really interested in who is this Swan?
The notes at the end, I mentioned that Ivan Doig wrote a book about Swan and a book about Doig digging into Swan's diaries and all the archives of Swan. It's called Winter Brothers.
So a beacon.
A beacon. So this takes place off Smith Island in 2015. So we know Swan is long dead, but this is Swan brought into this current world, contemporary world. In a previous poem, I talk about Smith Island, where Swan visited the new lighthouse that was there, which has since washed into the Salish Sea and is no longer exists and hasn't for a number of decades. A beacon off Smith Island, 2015. Keats coughs. Gasps, coughs again. The big red heart sputters in the engine room, gasps, then goes silent in the paralyzing silence of the sea at dead calm. Keats has broken down off Smith Island, halfway across the strait, near the convergence zone of four major shipping lanes. No place to be broken on water, but no ships in sight, no fog. Much too deep to drop anchor, but currents will keep us off shoals at least on this tide. We radio for tow, alert vessel control, and calm ourselves down as one becalmed in an afternoon autumn sun. Slowly we bob with the gulls on the lazy swell of the sea. So easy to daydream a lighthouse back on Smith Island, the one that stood a century and more before it slid down the wave-battered bluffs into the Salish Sea. The tower, bright-washed, the coned roof, red as the eye can see. The light new again as in 1859, and there's Swan, the newcomer, the curious correspondent who is finding his way in these northwest waters, James G. Swan, like a beacon himself, as he stands there in my imagination, a beacon of 19th century words that beckoned me north, midlife, when I was lost in a California life that was inland and far too safe. So here we lie, dead in the water, and now Swan's eye behind the keeper's spyglass is upon us in my imagined scene, a curious eye that peers across 150 years to find us aboard a broken boat, named for the poet Swan recited in school. Do the first few lines of To Autumn hum in his mind? Or the famous epitaph the poet insisted be his future? Here lies one whose name was writ in water.
That covers quite a bit of territory.
Yeah. I was just thinking that myself. I don't even know how to explain how it goes from one part of the territory to another. But the way this section works is that it starts out with a poem about Swan, and then the next poem is about Seattle, South, and then Swan, and then this is the poem that comes right before a beacon, precedes a beacon. The question of who, Nisqually, 1854. The question of who owned the land and who got to live where on Puget Sound was settled in the mind of Isaac Stevens by 1854, when he bullied the chiefs into treaties that left their people little to live for, though South, chief of the Duwamish and Suquamish, warned everybody, "Let him be just and deal kindly with my people, for the dead are not powerless." But live they did, those Salish tribes, or else, see else dead, rose from the other world in 1974, when the question of who owned the salmon and who got to fish where was settled in the mind of Judge George Bolt, based on the premises of and promises in those forgotten treaties Governor Stevens bludgeoned into law.
And then Judge Bolt comes in to bolt it.
I remember at one point, your territory, they were talking about, or down south of you, that part of Tacoma and part of Olympia, technically following that treaty, the treaties they signed, would be their homeland. Obviously, they made trade-offs to make it work. The Bolt decision was crucial to the financial improvement of almost all the tribes in this area.
We will now go to the seal's grave for the follow-up.
If you were around here in 2001, Self's grave in Suquamish, which is a kind of a combination of Christian burial and Salish burial customs, It's a place that I, when we first moved here, whenever anybody would visit, I would take them over to the grave and show them around the area and the grave. So when I found out that, read that it had been badly vandalized, I didn't really know what to think about it. But shortly after that, on a dog walk, this poem just came to me virtually. And by the time I got home, I was able to just write it word after memorized word. After vandalism, Self's grave, Suquamish, 2001. How do you bless a house when no church attends it? And if a god is waiting in the green room, he has missed his cues for years and sends no stand-in Francis to go and repair the house and embrace the birds, not to mention the fish and whales of Puget Sound. Now that Self has surely left us, who will come to bless? No. Who will even grace this house, a single grave from now?
It's amazing sometimes what helps the dead rise from the graves. You mentioned he'd be one perhaps who'd come from the dead to show the power of the old tribes.
Broken by water. Who hasn't been broken by water and those that take to water? Praise American widgeons, the alert covey they become in the protected coves of Yukon Harbor, each turning tail up, bottom feeding at low tide, tail feathers agape like hungry beaks. Praise the delicate grebes, working rougher water out past the point, and the heavy-headed mallards, the three of them, two hens quacking behind the haughty male. Praise the kingfisher, its loneliness, the high-perched patience of a Christ looking down. Who doesn't break into tears or praise or both? When the truck horn blares and the widgeon spook lifting off water as one taken to air.
Well, thank you so much, Gary, for helping us with the way we can break things. But your poems, of course, are made much more alive by the whole living experience that you have incorporated in it. And besides taking us on interesting odysseys, you've also given us history lessons that need to be returned to for finding out who we are ourselves and who our other selves have been. It's amazing book of poetry. Gary, thank you so much for coming on Sound Poetry.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks for inviting me and entertaining me, instructing me. Thank you.
This is Sound Poetry, and you've been listening to the Salish Sea Years by Gary Thompson, Broken by Water, the title. I'm your host, David Gilmore. Thank you for listening.